The Hangings by Bill Pronzini. Narrated by Barry Campbell. Chapter 1. It was Sam McCullough who found the hanged man down on the creek bank behind his saddlery shop. Straight away he came looking for me, being as I was the town constable and Tule Bend's only full-time peace officer. But he ran into Ed Bozeman first. Bose, who was both a close friend and my part-time deputy, was on his way to the Far West Milling Company, where he also works part-time. So it was the two of them that showed up at my house on 2nd Street. Mine and my sister Ivy's, I should say. Time was half an hour past sunup on a Wednesday, one of those frosty mornings Northern California sometimes gets in the early part of November. Ivy and I were having breakfast. She is 5 years older than my 31. We were both born in that house and have lived in it together pretty much ever since. She went to answer the ring at the door and showed Bose and Sam into the dining room. When Sam told about the hanged man, she let out a little shriek, but none of us paid her any mind. Ivy has a dramatic way about her at the best of times, even when the things that shock her are no more meaningful than fleas on a dog's back. It's just one of her faults. But in this case, she had cause. I was more than a little shocked myself, and had trouble believing it at first. Nothing like a hanging had ever happened in Tule Bend. This was such a peaceable little town that I sometimes wondered why the council didn't vote me out of a job, since I did so little to earn my pay. Sam said, "Well, how do you think I felt, Link?" Like Ivy, he was an excitable sort, and close to dithering right now. "I like to had a hemorrhage when I seen him hanging there on that black oak. Damned a sight a man ever stumbled on." He had forgot himself by cursing in front of Ivy. She was hell on cursing, Ivy was, but she was so upset herself she didn't even notice. She said, "You say he's a stranger, Mr. McCullough?" "Stranger to me. Never seen him before." "You make sure he's dead?" I asked. That earned me a snort. "I ain't even going to answer that," he said. "You just come along and see for yourself." I got my coat and derby and asked Ivy to go and inform Doc Peterson, who lived a block away. Then I hustled out with Sam and Bose. The air was knife-edge cold, the sky clear and brittle-looking, like blue painted glass. The sun had the look of a two-day-old egg yolk. When we came in alongside the saddlery, I saw that there was mist on the surface of Petaluma Creek, coils and streamers of it among the tules downstream. And on the grass along here and down on the creek bank, there was a layer of silvery frost. You could hear it crunch when you walked on it. The hanged man had frost on him, too. He was strung up on the old oak that grew between the saddlery and the creek, opposite a high board fence separating Sam's property from Joel Pennywell's carpentry shop next door. Dressed mostly in black, he was. Black denims, black boots, black cutaway coat that had seen better days. He had black hair, too, long and none too clean, and a black tongue pushed out at one corner of a black mottled face. All that black was streaked in silver, and there was silver on the rope that stretched between his neck and the thick limb above. He was the damnedest sight a man ever stumbled on, for a fact. Frozen up there, silver and black, glistening in the cold sunlight like something cast up from the pit. We stood looking at him for a time, not saying anything. There was a thin wind off the marshes downstream, and I could feel it prickling up the hairs on my neck. But it did not stir the hanged man, nor any part of him or his clothing. Bose cleared his throat, did it loud enough to make me jump. "You know him, Link?" "No," I said. "You?" "No, drifter, you think?" "Got the look of one." Which he did. He had been about halfway through his 30s, smallish, with a clean-shaven fox face and pointy ears. His clothes were shabby, shirt cuffs frayed, button missing off his cutaway coat. Drifters came through this area all the time, up from San Francisco or over from the mining country after their luck and their money ran out. Men looking for river or farm or cattle work or such other jobs as they could find. Sometimes looking for trouble, too. Bose and I had caught one just 2 weeks before and locked him up in the town jail for chicken stealing. "What I want to know," Sam said, "is what the hell he's doing here." Bose shrugged and took off his cap and rubbed at his bald spot, the way he always does when he's fuddled. He was the same age as me, but he had been losing his hair for the past 10 years. In another 10, he'd be as bald as an egg. He said, "Appears he's been hanging a while, all night maybe." I asked Sam, "What time'd you close up last evening?"
6, same as usual.
Stay on long?
About an hour.
See anyone when you left?
Nope, sure not him.
Could have happened any time after 7 then. It's a lonely spot back here after dark. Don't suppose there's much chance anybody saw what happened.
Joel Pennywell stays open late some nights, Bose said.
Well, we can ask him.
Sam said, but why would anybody lynch a man like that?
If he was lynched, might be he did it himself.
Suicide?
It has been known to happen. Doc Peterson showed up just then, a couple of other citizens with him. Word was starting to get around, thanks to Ivy. Doc, who was 60 and dyspeptic, squinted up at the corpse, grunted, and said,
"Strangulation."
"Doc?"
"Strangulation. Man strangled to death. You can see that from the way his tongue's out. Neck's not broken. You can see that, too."
"Does that mean he could have hanged himself?"
"All it means," Doc said, "is that he didn't jump off a high branch or get jerked hard enough off a horse to break his neck."
"Wasn't a horse back here anyway," I said. "Be shoe marks if there had been. Ground was soft enough last night before the freeze. Boot prints here and there, but that's all."
"I don't know anything about that," Doc said in his crusty way. "All I know is that gent up there died of strangulation. You want me to tell you anything else, you'll have to get him down first."
I sent Sam to the saddlery to fetch a plank and a horse blanket. The other end of the rope was tied tight around one of the lower branches. I reached up and sawed through it with my pocket knife. Then Bose and I lowered the body to the ground. It was not good work. My mouth was dry when it was done. While Doc took a look at the dead man, Bose and I went over the area. There was nothing to find. I got down and peered at the clearest of the boot tracks to see if there might be something distinctive about the footwear that had made them. One pair narrow, the other wide, that was all. The narrow tracks appeared to have been made by the cracked and worn black boots on the dead man's feet. When Sam came back, we laid the corpse on the plank he'd brought and covered it with the blanket. Then we carried it out to Doc's wagon, and Bose and I went along to Spencer's undertaking parlor. After Doc and Obie Spencer stripped the body, I went through the clothing. There was no identification of any kind. If he had been carrying any before he died, somebody had filched it. No wallet or purse either. All he had in his pocket was the stub of a lead pencil, some lucifers, a short 6 Seeger, a nearly empty Bull Durham sack, 3 wheat straw papers, a silver dollar and a 2-bit piece, an old Spanish real coin, and a dog-eared and stained copy of the Beetle Dime novel called Captain Dick Talbot, King of the Road, or The Black Hoods of Shasta.
"Drifter, all right," Bose said when I was done. "Don't see how he could be anything else."
I nodded. "But even drifters have more belongings than this. Shaving gear, extra clothes, at least that much."
"You'd think so. Might be he had a carpet bag or the like, and it's somewhere along the creek bank."
"Either that or it was stolen," I said. "We'll have to go look when Doc gets through." Doc did not have much to tell us when he came out. The hanged man had been shot once a long time ago. He had bullet scars on his right shoulder and back, and one foot was missing a pair of toes. There was also a fresh bruise on the left side of his head, above the ear. I asked, "Big bruise, Doc?"
"Big enough."
"Could he have been hit on the head hard enough to knock him out?"
"By somebody who hung him afterward, you mean?"
"That's what I mean."
"Good possibility of it, I'd say. Rope burns and lacerations on his neck, just as there'd be if somebody hauled him up over that tree limb."
"Can you tell how long he's been dead?"
"Last night sometime, best I can do."
Bose and I headed back to the saddlery. The town had come alive by this time. Merchants had opened their shops along the 4-block business district, and there were citizens on the boardwalks, horses and wagons and bicycles moving along the rutted surface of Main Street.
the dead man was getting plenty of lip service on Main and among the crowd that had gathered back of the saddlery to gawk at the black oak and trample the grass. Several people tried to buttonhole Bose and me. I ignored them, and he took my cue and did the same. But we could only get away with that temporarily. Fact is, nothing much goes on in a small town like Tule Bend, and such a bizarre thing as a hanging was bound to stir folks' imaginations. There had not been a killing in the area in years. And damn little mystery since the days when General Mariano Vallejo owned most of the land hereabouts, and it was the Mexican flag, not the Stars and Stripes, that flew over California. None of the crowd had found anything in the way of evidence on the creek bank. They would have come running to tell me if they had. None of them seemed to know anything about the hanged man either. That included Joel Pennywell, who had come over from his carpentry shop. He had closed up around 7:30 last night, he said, and gone straight home. Bose and I commenced a search along the creek, southward first. Creek is what it's called, but actually it's a saltwater estuary, 14 miles long, running through long stretches of tule marsh and mud flats between Petaluma, a few miles north of Tule Bend, and San Pablo Bay, and so full of twists and turns that steamboat pilots never dare to take their eyes from the stream the whole way up or down for fear of their vessels floundering in the mud. There was activity on the creek now, too. A clumsy-looking scow schooner loaded with lumber had made its way upstream from San Francisco, and two of its crew, on shore with slings around their chests and tow lines stretching back to the foremasthead, were pulling her into the wharf at Beecher's Lumber Yard up near the basin. Another schooner, this one's broad deck loaded with eggs and squawking poultry, was just passing under the basin drawbridge on its way downstream. There was always plenty of creek traffic, no matter what the time of year. Scow schooners, melon boats, fishing boats, barges, dredgers. A steamer now and then, too, though the sternwheelers did not ply the creek nearly so often as in the old days, now that the San Francisco and North Pacific Railroad was well established. Folks in this part of Sonoma County ship all sorts of farm and factory goods down to San Francisco by way of the creek. Fish, hay, hides, horses and cattle, dairy products, huge quantities of eggs and poultry, and we import quantities just as large of grain and feed, lumber and hardwood, glass, hardware, and vehicles of one kind or another. The day had warmed some, the wind was down, and the sun had burned off the last of the frost and mist. A few other townspeople joined Bose and me, eager and boisterous, as if we were on an Easter egg hunt. It was too soon for the full impact of the hanging to settle in on most folks. Hadn't occurred to them yet that maybe they ought to be concerned. A few minutes before 10, while we were combing the bank up near the basin and still not finding anything, the Whipple youngster came pedaling up on his bicycle to tell me that Roberto Ortega and Morton Brandeis wanted to see me at the Brandeis livery barn. Roberto owned a dairy ranch just south of town and claimed to be a descendant of a Spanish conquistador, which he probably was. He was an honest man and a good citizen, two facts that contributed to his being in town this morning. He had found a saddled horse grazing on his pasture land and figured it for a runaway from the livery, so he'd brought it in. But Morton had never seen the animal before Roberto showed up with it, nor had he seen the carpet bag that was tied to the saddle. When the Whipple boy finished telling about the horse and carpet bag, Bose said, "They must belong to the dead man, Link. Maybe there's something in the carpet bag to tell us who he is." I said, "We'll go find out." Chapter 2. The livery barn was on the south end of town, on the creek bank near where Main Street hooked over and turned into Tule Bend Road. The main San Rafael Petaluma Road was a fifth of a mile to the west along there. Morton Brandeis and Roberto Ortega and Morton's helper, Jacob Pike, were waiting out front. Morton was a handsome, taciturn, dour man who wore a black leather engineer's cap every day of his life, rain or shine. Would have worn it to church, it was said, if he was a religious man, which he wasn't. He hadn't always been dour, or at least not so noticeably as in the past 6 months. His wife, Lucy, had taken sick in early spring and was confined to her bed.
Doc Peterson said she had some kind of bone disease and would never walk again. Privately, Doc had told me her chances of living much more than a year were pretty slim. I liked Morton well enough, and I liked Roberto, but I did not much care for Jacob Pike. He was young and not too bright, good-looking in a slickery kind of way. He used so much pomade on his hair that I had seen it melt and run down his face like sweat on hot days, and he fancied himself a pistol with the girls. He was always making sly remarks to females, regardless of how old they were. He had made one to Ivy once, and I hadn't heard the end of it for weeks. On a Saturday night, he would hang around in front of the Sonoma Pool Emporium with a couple of his friends and whistle and throw his sly remarks at any woman who happened to pass by. I had had to warn him more than once about his language. He had never been in any real trouble, with a woman or otherwise. "Not many girls silly enough," Bowes had said once, "to want to consort with a fellow that smells of lilac grease and horse shit." But I had always figured the potential was there. Morton said, "Stray's inside, Link." I nodded. "You look inside the carpet bag?" "Nope, waiting on you." "I looked," Roberto said, "when I found the horse." "Anything to identify the owner?" "Not that I saw, but I didn't look closely." "Where'd you find him?" "Near my front gate, nuzzling grass." We all went into the barn. It was a big, cavernous building, cleaner than most liveries. Morton was a stickler for that, and more than three-quarters of the stalls were occupied. Ever since I was a boy, I've liked the mingled smells inside a livery barn, the heavy, warm odor of animals, the dusty savor of leather and hay and manure. I used to devil Ivy with descriptions like that. She is the type who finds offense in any smell stronger than sachet or cut flowers or baking bread. How she ever brings herself to enter the privy out back of the house has always been a wonder to me. Puts a clothespin on her nose, maybe. The horse in the stall Morton led us to was a whiskery, sway-backed roan that ought to have been turned out to pasture instead of still serving duty as a saddle animal. The saddle he wore was a cheap Mexican type, cracked in places, and the carpet bag tied behind the cantle was old and battered. All in all, the belongings of a man down on his luck. A drifter who had never been anywhere much and who was on his way to more of the same. On his way to a grave now, if he was the man lying on Obie Spencer's embalming table. Pike said, "I'll untie that bag for you, Mr. Evans," and started into the stall. "No, you won't," I said. "I'll do it." He gave me a look and backed off. He didn't like me any more than I did him. The rawhide strings came off with no trouble. I lifted the bag down and carried it back to the front doors where the light was better and there was a table to put it on. The others followed, grouping around while I opened the bag. Inside there were two changes of clothing, both old and worn. A rain slicker, a Colt Dragoon revolver, unloaded, the barrel speckled with rust spots. Shaving tackle and a woman's garter, soiled, the elastic broken. I commenced a search of the clothing and that's when I found the letter, folded up in the pocket of one of the shirts. It was in its envelope, and the envelope was addressed to Jeremy Bodine, care of General Delivery, Marysville. In the upper left-hand corner was a return address, E. Bodine, Delta Hotel, Stockton. I pinched the letter out and opened it. Single page of notepaper, dated 3 weeks ago yesterday, the words on it written in a bold, untidy hand. It said, "Dear Brother, I am now in Stockton and trust you are still in Marysville, as you said you would be stopping there until the 31st of the month. I am on to something here which I believe will pay big money, and I mean big. I am not exaggerating. There is more than enough for both of us if you are interested in giving up the normal life for the lap of luxury. Write to me at the Delta Hotel, downtown, and let me know if you will be coming here and when. Emmett." Bowes had been reading over my shoulder. He said, "Sounds kind of mysterious, don't it?" "Not necessarily," I said, "but it did." "Well, at least we know the dead man's name, Jeremy Bodine." "So it would seem." I asked Morton if he would board the roan at city expense. He said he would. Then Bowes and I took the carpet bag over to Obie Spencer's to put with the rest of the hanged man's belongings.
I would have liked Bose to join me in asking around about this Jeremy Bodine, if that was his name, but a pair of grain barges were due upstream from San Francisco at 11 for unloading and return, and Bose was expected at Far West Milling to help with the work. His job at Far West paid more than his position as deputy constable, and he had a wife and two kids to support. So I let him go. I could make inquiries on my own once I was finished with a couple of things that needed doing first. There were none of those newfangled telephones in Tule Bend yet, though there probably would be before much longer. Mayor Gladstone was talking of having poles and wires strung in and telephones installed in the city offices. When that finally happened, Ivy would be the first private citizen in line for one of the things. Then she wouldn't have to leave the house to do her tongue wagging. Until Mr. Bell's invention arrived, our main line of communication with the rest of the world would continue to be Western Union. So I walked on down to their office and composed a wire to Emmett Bodine, care of the Delta Hotel in Stockton. Regret to inform you, man found dead here today under suspicious circumstances may be your brother Jeremy. Stop. Positive identification necessary. Stop. Please contact undersigned as soon as possible. Lincoln Evans, Town Constable, Tule Bend. I gave the yellow sheet of paper to the day telegrapher, Elmer Davies. Send it right away, will you, Elmer? And if there's a reply, let me know as soon as it comes in. Will do, Link. I probably should have sent a second wire to the county sheriff's office in Santa Rosa informing Joe Perkins of what had happened here this morning, but I didn't do it. Perkins was next to useless as a law enforcement officer, just a fat-bottomed political hack who came through Tule Bend once or twice a month to look things over and to stuff himself on pig's knuckles and sauerkraut at the Germany Cafe. Nothing would get done if I turned the investigation over to him. As a matter of fact, he would stir folks up even more with his ham-fisted ways, turn the hanging into a circus sideshow. I made my way to the Odd Fellows Hall on First, a block from the Basin. It was a two-story building, the lower half of which housed the city offices. The old joke about the town officials being pretty odd fellows in their own right was wearing thin, perhaps thin enough to shame people into voting the necessary funds for a new city hall next election. I sure as hell hope so. The constable's office and jail were at the rear. You could get there by going in through the front, but that way you had to pass the town clerk's office, the mayor's office, and the council chambers. I always entered by way of the alley at the rear, the way the council had decreed prisoners were to be taken in and out, so as not to offend the more sensitive among our citizens. Not that there were ever many prisoners to offend anybody. A few Saturday night drunks and an occasional sneak thief or vandal was about all. But Vern Gladstone, who had been mayor for the past 12 years, was hell on appearances, which was also a local joke, considering that Vern weighed 300 pounds. He was his own best customer at the Gladstone Brewery, and had a knack for wearing expensive suits in a way that they looked like a rag picker's hand-me-downs. I made sure the mayor was nowhere to be seen before I went around and down the alley to my office. He was a windy old coot, and once he got his conversational hooks into you, you were hard-pressed to wriggle free. This hanging business would sharpen his tongue and make him even more loquacious than usual. There was a file of wanted circulars on my desk. I got it out and leafed through them. I had no particular reason for thinking that Jeremy Bodine might be wanted, but I was bothered by the curious way he had died and the wording of that letter from his brother. But if he was wanted anywhere, neither his face nor his name was among the circulars I had collected. I didn't have a flyer on an Emmett Bodine either. That done, I headed back down to the creek bank behind Sam McCullough's saddlery. There was still some folks out gawking and poking around, kids mostly. None of them had anything to tell me about the dead man. I moved upstream, following the bank to where it bellied in to form the western rim of the basin. The creek was nearly 100 yards wide there. The town wharf jutted out midway along on this side, and there were also docks for Far West Milling, Beecher's Lumber Yard, and one of three big storage warehouses, Creekside Drayage. The other two warehouses were on the east bank. The east side was the poorer section of town. The SF and NP tracks and depot were over there.
So was what Ivy and others called Shantytown, where railroad workers and rivermen lived with their families, and there were several working-class saloons and lodging houses. The grain barges were in at the far west dock, and I saw Bose working on them with some other men. No point in my asking questions there. I went ahead to Creekside Drayage and talked to half a dozen men and did not find out a thing. I was of a mind then to make inquiries on the east side, but it was quite a while before I got to do that. A great big gust of wind stopped me when I got to the Basin Drawbridge. The wind's name was Vern Gladstone, and as I had feared, he was all set to blow up a storm. Over supper that night, Ivy asked, "Haven't you a clue to what that man was doing there, Lincoln? Not even a clue?" "Nope," I said. "Nobody seems to have seen him around town, or anywhere else for that matter."
"Well, then, he couldn't have taken his own life."
"Why not?"
"Pshaw, a man doesn't ride into a strange town, a place where he doesn't know a soul, and hang himself on the creek bank."
She had a point, and I admitted it. "But on the other hand," I said, "a man doesn't ride into a strange town where he doesn't know a soul and get himself hung by somebody else either. Shot or knifed, possibly, if he had money or valuables worth stealing, but not hanged."
"Mightn't he have had money or valuables? You said you didn't find a wallet or purse."
"He might have, yes. But then why was he wearing shabby clothes and riding an old swayback horse?"
"It hardly makes sense any other way."
"Maybe it will when I hear from Emmett Bodine."
"Why haven't you heard? My land, you sent that wire this morning."
"Ivy," I said with more patience than I felt, because these were the same sort of questions Mayor Gladstone had bombarded me with earlier. "Emmett Bodine may be working long hours at his job, or he may have left Stockton on business, or he may have left Stockton for good. How the devil do I know, one way or another?" Her mouth and nose got pinched up together in the middle of her face, as usually happens when she's annoyed or offended or outraged, or all three at once. It makes her look like one of the witches in Macbeth.
"I'll thank you not to curse at the dinner table, Lincoln," she said in her schoolmarmish voice.
"Devil isn't a curse word."
"It is as far as I'm concerned."
"Ivy,
eat your stew, if you please."
I sighed and went on eating my stew. It was good stew. Tasty cooking is one of Ivy's virtues, one of the few. She is my sister and I love her, but living with her can be a god-awful chore sometimes. I don't know why I don't move out, take a room at the Union Hotel or one of the lodging houses, except that this is as much my home as it is hers. No room I could rent would be half as comfortable. Still, the prospect of spending the rest of my life under this roof with Ivy is not one I care to dwell on. If I don't move out sooner or later, that is what will happen. Ivy surely isn't going to leave. She has lived here all her life, except for the time 10 years ago when she married Herman Edwards and moved to San Francisco to set up housekeeping with him. The marriage lasted 3.5 months. When she came back, she told everyone poor Herman had died of the grip. But I found out later that he was not only alive and kicking, but still selling drug sundries for his livelihood, and that he had been the one to have the marriage annulled. Ivy wasn't bad-looking when she was dressed properly and smiled rather than scowled down her pinched nose, and she had had a couple of other suitors in the past 10 years, but they had all gone away before long. She was not interested in men. She was interested in gossip and giving orders and finding fault with people and being offended by some of the most natural and inoffensive things you can imagine. She was an old maid at heart, with an outlook on life that would have stood her in good stead with John Calvin and the other Puritans. It was a hell of a thing for a brother to think, but I'd always suspected poor Herman Edwards had the marriage annulled out of sheer frustration because he had been unable to convince Ivy to consummate their union. We finished dinner in silence, which was fine with me. I helped Ivy clear the table. She asked me if I wanted to have coffee in the parlor, and I said no. Instead, I went and got one of my pipes and my tobacco pouch. Ivy doesn't allow smoking in the house, and put them into the pocket of my sheepskin coat. I was struggling into the coat when Ivy came into the front hall.
"Lincoln, where are you going?"
"Out to make my rounds."
"No, you're not," she said. You're off to see that woman again.
Ivy, don't start on me.
Well, you are. Why don't you admit it?
What I do is my business.
Not when it comes home to roost with me. Don't you think the whole town knows? Don't you think people are talking? Why, just yesterday, Melissa Conroy...
Melissa Conroy is a gossipy old biddy.
Lincoln!
And so are you, I thought, but I didn't say it. Tell her to tend to her own damn knitting.
Watch your language. Why do you always have to curse in front of me?
I buttoned my coat and went to the door.
You know what kind of a woman she is. You know it, Lincoln Evans. Why do you persist in seeing her? Can't you control your carnal appetites? Can't you understand how humiliated I feel when people tell me they've seen you sneaking up the hill to her house?
I walked out and put the door between me and Ivy, between me and her nasty, wagging tongue.